It's the biggest case in a quarter century on abortion, and legal experts are saying this week's Supreme Court ruling could have a ripple effect. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, legal experts Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa and Tony Goggin of Drake walk us through the landmark abortion case and the significance of the decision. Also, a look at other high-profile Supreme Court cases this session, including a decision that has supporters of affirmative action cheering and an immigration case that dealt a setback to President Obama's immigration plans. Join us with your questions about these cases and the workings of our nation's highest court. First, this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's the biggest case in a quarter century on abortion. Legal experts saying this week's Supreme Court ruling could have a ripple effect. One of the cases we'll be looking at this hour on River to River, as we've invited two legal experts into our studio to talk not only about that big case, which was announced, the decision was announced yesterday, but also other cases before our high court this hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining me this hour is Tony Goggin. He is a professor of law at Drake University's Law School, and we want to welcome you into our Des Moines studio. Hello again, Tony.
Hello, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here.
Teaming up with Tony, Todd Pettis, professor and chair of the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Todd, welcome back to you.
Thanks for the invitation.
We have this team back. We just love having you explain the cases, the stories behind the cases, and what they mean for going forward for our country. At the end of the hour, I also want to talk a little bit about, of course, the vacant ninth seat, how long that may be vacant, what kind of precedent that sets. But before that, we want to talk about these cases and invite our listeners. If you have questions about these cases we're talking about today before the U.S. Supreme Court or about the workings of the nation's highest court, please join our conversation 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, our email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, tweet us at IPR Talk, or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Political questions about the high court, not today. Actually, politics Wednesday is tomorrow, so set your timer for tomorrow at noon, and we'll be talking about that. Todd Pettis, let me turn to you to have some comments about this case, the decision handed down yesterday. Few issues have left Americans so deeply splintered as this issue, abortion, philosophical, religious, legal questions about when life begins, about the rights of an unborn fetus, and about the legal authority of a woman to choose to do what with her body. So tell us, how did this case get started? What is the basis of it?
Well, the case is Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt, and you described it well in your opening. It's undoubtedly the most important abortion rights case in the last quarter century. And just to be clear up front, it was a 5-3 decision, and so this is not a case that was affected by Justice Scalia's absence. Even if he had been present and had joined the other conservatives in dissent, it still would have been a dissent. The vote would have been 5-4 instead of 5-3. So the case concerned a Texas law, but it's not just a Texas law, because indirectly there are about half the nation's states have versions of these laws on the books, too, that are all affected by these rulings. And here's what Texas law said. It said two things. Number one, if you're a physician performing an abortion, you have to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles so that if something goes wrong with your patient, you and the patient together can go to this hospital and you have access to those services. You have to have those within 30 miles. Well, that requirement right there cut Texas's number of clinics roughly in half, down from 40 to roughly 20. There's some dispute around the margin.
They just had to close.
They had to close because they're not geographically placed close enough to a hospital. And as Justice Breyer ultimately, in the majority opinion that we'll get to, points out, it's not necessarily easy for an abortion-performing physician to get hospital or admitting privileges at a hospital, because a lot of hospitals evidently will give those privileges to a doctor only if that doctor is going to supply a fairly regular source of business. And so if the abortions that you perform are very safe and you rarely, if ever, have complications, so you never need a hospital, you might not be generating the kind of business that would cause a hospital to give you admitting privileges. So that was one of the requirements. And the other one was that the clinic itself in which you perform the procedure has to be equipped in a way that was comparable with what Texas called an ambulatory surgical facility. So this is, it's an outpatient facility, but it's not, you know, like we have for the University of Iowa, for example, has Quick Care here in town, and other towns across Iowa may have versions of these where it kind of walk-in clinics for kind of low-level.
No appointment needed.
Yeah. We're talking, what Texas law said is that kind of facility is clearly inadequate. It has to be up to the standard of where you would perform complex surgical procedures. And if your facility, if your clinic is not equipped in this way, then you can't perform abortions there. Well, it's very expensive. It involves, these requirements have staffing requirements, they have staffing components, square footage components. You've got to have one-way traffic patterns leading from the pre-op suite to the operation suite to the post-op recovery room, HVAC requirements, a whole list of things. And a lot of clinics said, we can't afford these. Either our footprint for the land we have, we can't expand, or we don't have the money. And so if both of these requirements went in, the number of clinics in Texas would have dropped from 40 to something in the single digits, or that's what they said. And the court here struck both of those requirements down as unconstitutional. In a nutshell, the test that they were applying is what we call the undue burden test. And we've referenced a couple times the most important case in the last quarter century. What we're measuring it from is Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which was decided in the early 1990s. And that's the case that gave us the undue burden test that gets applied here. And what that test says is if a state wants to restrict a woman's ability to terminate a pregnancy prior to viability, so the fetus is not yet viable, the state can impose some restrictions, but those restrictions cannot rise to the level of being an undue burden. Okay? Mm-hmm. And what the court held is that both of these requirements, when put into practice, would impose an undue burden. It would greatly increase the driving distance that many women would face. You'd have fewer clinics trying to handle the state's entire caseload, and so waiting times would increase. And as waiting times increase, the possibility of complications in the procedure itself also increases. Okay. So struck down as unconstitutional for being an undue burden. One other thing that's, I think, important about this case is the court shed light really for the first time on what that phrase undue burden means, which is when deciding whether a burden that's placed on a woman is due or undue, we got to look at what are the benefits of the law and what are the costs. And here the court said, you know, neither of these restrictions in any kind of demonstrable way actually increases women's health. Okay. And I just, final point here, both the New York Times and the Washington Post have up on their websites today maps showing the nation and showing in which states laws like these are in force. And it's, there's not a strict correlation, but there's clearly, I think, a perceptible red-blue state correlation. It's the red states where laws like this, ostensibly adopted in the name of trying to protect women's health, have been put into force. And it's, you know, you look to the West Coast or the Northeast, kind of reliably blue areas, and those states don't have versions of these laws. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of indirectly behind what the court says, is, you know, if you're...
I understand Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote a separate opinion that concurred with the majority.
She did, and it was short. And it's gotten some attention. I'm a little surprised by the attention it's gotten. I think she, you know, she carries a great deal of respect, but really just kind of in a nutshell pointing out the threat that these laws pose, that these laws are, you know, clearly aimed, in her view, as it was made clear, I think, during oral argument, at just restricting abortion access. It's not about actually improving women's
health. Okay, so talk about the implications. Does this end this question of all, once and for all, this, I guess, the idea of this strategy of reducing the number of facilities that offer abortion services through these type of laws?
No, I don't think it ends it at all. And the reason why is because Texas's law, let's just take the requirement that it be equipped like an ambulatory surgical center. It's a long, long list of requirements. So a state that wants to adopt a law like this is going to say, okay, let's not impose all those requirements. How about half the things on that list? What about that? Mm-hmm. And what would be the cost of those? And what would the health benefits be?
And so this ruling was not clear where that line is.
No. And there's no way that the court could draw a line like that, I think, because it really turns on the specifics of the state law. What are the health benefits of those particular requirements that the state has chosen to impose? What are the costs that the clinics would have to carry? So I think we're going to see a lot of litigation about kind of lesser dialed down versions of what Texas had tried to do here.
Mm-hmm. How much of a surprise was this 5-3 ruling? Were most court watchers expecting a 4-4 split?
No. And the reason why is going back to Planned Parenthood versus Casey 25 years ago, Justice Kennedy was part of that opinion. Justice Kennedy was among the justices who gave us the undue burden test. It's been clear for a long time that while he has indeed voted in some cases to uphold abortion restrictions, he's not of the view like Justice Thomas. Justice Thomas wrote a separate opinion here saying, I firmly oppose to the notion that there's any constitutional right at play here. We know that that's not Justice Kennedy's view. And so I think because the state had a hard time at oral argument, they were asked, how many cases can you point to where these requirements you've imposed actually would have made a difference in a woman's life? And the state essentially said, we can't point to any of those cases, but it's possible it could happen.
Mm-hmm. Did the Iowa Supreme Court case on telemedicine abortion figure into this case at all?
Not that I noticed. Now, the opinions are about 110 pages in length, and so it could be that there's a citation in there. I haven't mm-hmm. looked specifically for it. But that case, I would say, is kind of very much in the same spirit as this case, where a state is imposing a requirement, in that case saying you can't perform an abortion, you know, remotely through this video conference
by unlocking a drawer and having a pill there.
Yeah. One of the questions there was, you know, why are you not allowing this when you would allow it for other kinds of health-related procedures where again, weighing benefits and burdens of the rules that a state's imposing?
Okay. Todd Pettis is with us of the University of Iowa College of Law, talking about this decision handed down yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court. We want to talk about, if you have a question about this case, the legal aspects of it. We're not dealing with the politics of it today, but please do join our conversation. We're going to talk about several other cases this hour. 1-866-780-9100. Tony Goggin, also with us of the Drake University Law School. Tony, let me ask you about another case that was decided. The announcement was given, Fisher v. University of Texas. This is a case that involves a challenge to a race-conscious admissions program at the University of Texas in Austin. Tell us the story here.
That's exactly right, Ben. This was another Texas case. And in the case, Fisher v. University of Texas, the Supreme Court upheld the use of affirmative action in undergraduate admissions. The vote split was 4-3. Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion, and Justice Scalia died before the court issued this opinion. The reason why only 7 justices instead of 8 participated is because Justice Kagan recused herself from hearing the case because she had worked on related issues when she was Solicitor General. The bottom line of this case is that it establishes once again that affirmative action is a legitimate purpose for university admissions offices to promote. And in fact, in the view of Justice Kennedy, the fact that a white applicant
This is Fisher in this case.
This is Fisher, exactly. This particular case, Abigail Fisher was an applicant to the University of Texas in 2008, and she was denied admission. She was admitted to Louisiana State University and graduated, but because she was denied admission to the University of Texas, she had standing to pursue this case challenging the University of Texas's admissions policies. The case was 8 years long because it bounced back and forth between the Supreme Court and the Fifth Circuit. And the bottom line is, from the vantage point of the majority on the court, it is permissible under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution for public universities to use race as one factor, one criteria, in determining its admissions policies. Consequently, this case is important in that public universities around the country have a degree of confidence that they will be able to continue to use affirmative action as part of their admissions policies.
Mm-hmm. And the reason behind that is a university wants to be able to advertise itself, brand itself as a diverse community of learning. Is that right, sort of?
That's exactly right. In fact, Justice Kennedy expressly stated in the opinion that intangible factors like student body diversity are a legitimate admissions criteria. Affirmative action policies have been used since the early 1970s in university admissions, and they have been litigated before the Supreme Court almost constantly since the first federal affirmative action policies were adopted in the early 70s. One of the interesting developments in the last 10 to 15 years is the fact that originally affirmative action was conceived of in the context of an admissions pool that primarily consists of white applicants and African-American applicants. But over the course of the past several decades, the United States has become even more diverse. In fact, the second largest minority group, or the largest minority group in the country today is Latinos, and the fastest growing minority group is Asian Americans. And so the diversity that universities attempt to promote through their admissions policies does change over time because the way America looks has changed over time. And so that then gives rise to a whole host of additional legal questions that undoubtedly will resurface in future Supreme Court cases. But for the moment, and I think for some time to come, affirmative action policies in public universities are on safe grounds.
Mm-hmm. So universities, colleges, happy about this? I guess who is in the unhappy camp?
Well, I would say certainly applicants who are denied admission to universities like Texas, public universities like Abigail Fisher, will continue to be unhappy with these policies. And in the background of all this is a recognition that we have not been able to come up with admissions criteria that adequately reach working class applicants. And there's a whole variety of reasons for this. At the Ivy League, for example, the percentage of students from working class backgrounds of all races has declined since the 1960s and 70s. And that's something that is being discussed in higher education circles. What can we do to broaden our admissions policies so that we're capturing all socioeconomic groups? And that's something that I think will be critically important as the country, and as we see in the case of Brexit in the UK on Thursday, and we see in part through Donald Trump's success in the Republican primaries, there is a tremendous amount of dissatisfaction among working class Americans in general. And big institutions like universities have been a target of that dissatisfaction. And so this is certainly not an opinion that will satisfy all potential constituencies out there, but I think it is something that preserves an important goal, which is to make sure that our universities reflect the diversity of the country as a whole.
Tony Goggin with us, professor of law at Drake University's Law School. Todd Pettis also on board, our two legal experts, Todd of the University of Iowa College of Law. And we're talking about major cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. We like to do this a couple times a year to catch up and find out in depth what how these cases are decided, the workings of the court, and the implications going forward of the decisions that are made. Todd Pettis, let me ask you about another one recently decided that had to do with domestic violence and gun ownership. Is this Voisin v. U.S.?
Right. Voisin versus United States. And Voisin, for people who are trying to look it up, is V-O-I-S-I-N-E. A lot of folks might remember that Justice Thomas made news this past term by asking a question for the first time
in 10 years?
Yeah, in about a decade. Yes, and this was that case, and his question concerned the Second Amendment and gun possession rights, and we'll see how that comes up here in just a second. Federal law, federal, United States law, makes it a crime to possess a firearm if you've been convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. So, and domestic violence is usually handled at the state level, but if within your state, say the state of Maine, which was the state at issue here, if you've been convicted of the misdemeanor of committing domestic violence, then you cannot possess a gun. And that holds forever. That was one of the things that Justice Thomas got concerned about at oral argument. But you forever lose your right to own a firearm. When we talk about criminal law, we always talk about states of mind, and states of mind were very much at the center of this case. And it had to do with how do we define what is a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. The statute tells us that it involves the, quote, use of force, okay, the use of physical force. If you harm someone you live with, a relative, and you're using physical force, then you have committed a crime, a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, and you lose your gun rights under federal law. Well, states define domestic violence differently. Mm. Most states, not Iowa, but most states say that you've committed a crime of domestic violence if you intend to hurt someone through your conduct or if you're merely being reckless. And what how the law defines recklessness is you do something aware of the risk that it's going to hurt someone. You don't intend to hurt someone, but you know that what you're doing could hurt someone. Then you're reckless. Okay. Well, if you're in one of those states, Iowa requires intent. If you're going to commit a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, you have to intend. They don't have a broader definition of it. But if you're in a state like Maine, a majority of states where it extends to recklessness crimes, does this federal statute cover you? Do you lose your gun rights? And both there were two cases.
And that's the question before the court in this case.
That's the question in this case. Two guys who had pled guilty years before to misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence. It was in the state of Maine where it extends to recklessness. Later on, they ran into trouble with the law. The feds found out that these guys owned guns, and so they were prosecuted for violating this federal law that says you can't have a gun. You've got this domestic violence history. And the court held here that the federal law does extend to just recklessness crimes, and they tried to define what does it mean to use physical force. Justice Kagan, who wrote the opinion, gave a couple of examples. She said, suppose, you know, you've got a couple that's in an argument. One of them throws a plate against the wall, and it shatters. When the person throws the plate against the wall, even if they don't intend to hurt someone, but suppose the person does get hurt, would we say that that person has used physical force?
Yeah.
Justice Kagan reads the statute saying yes. Or suppose you're having an argument with your spouse is following very closely behind you, you slam the door as soon as you pass through a doorway, knowing your spouse is right behind you.
Goes right into the
face. Aware of the fact that the person might get hurt. You don't intend to hurt them, but you know it could happen.
Yeah.
Justice Kagan and a majority of the court read the federal statute saying if that's the circumstances of your crime, you're still covered by this federal law. You lose your gun rights.
Okay, the implications of this decision going forward before we go to break here in just a few seconds?
It matters a lot in the 35 states that extend to recklessness. It doesn't matter in a state like Iowa that doesn't define domestic violence.
So even if it's deemed reckless in Iowa, you do not have your gun rights taken away?
In Iowa, you haven't committed a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. Intent is required. That's right. And this also sets up a future Second Amendment argument. Justice Thomas's concerns about the Second Amendment and whether you can really take away a person's gun rights forever for a crime like this, that issue is going to be back in front of the court at some point.
Todd Pettis is with us, professor at the University of Iowa College of Law, one of our legal experts, along with Tony Goggin of Drake University's Law School, talking about major cases before this U.S. Supreme Court this hour. If you have any questions about the workings of the court or any of the cases we're discussing this hour, 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, we'll talk about a case that has dealt a setback, a major setback to President Obama's immigration plans, also to so-called dreamers in this country. We'll also talk about, well, do you need a warrant for a breath test versus a blood test? That's something that the high court looked at. Also, a case of public corruption involving former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell. Those are all on board. When we come back, it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Support for IPR.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As we like to do several times a year, we're going in-depth to discuss major cases before, in this case, the U.S. Supreme Court. Sometimes we also do it with the Iowa Supreme Court. So these are cases having been decided, I think most of them, before the high court. And we're talking about them with our legal experts, Todd Pettis, the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law, and Tony Goggin, professor of law at Drake University's Law School. We invite your questions about the cases we're talking about this hour, also about the workings of our nation's highest court, politics of the court. We're going to leave till tomorrow. We may get a few discussions that have to do with the workings as they pertain to that vacant ninth seat toward the end of this hour. But let's continue talking about cases. Todd Pettis, let's talk with you. Have you tell us a little bit more about the case decided that dealt a blow to President Obama's plans for immigration. This is the United States v. Texas. What is this about?
Right. This is a case that was very much affected by Justice Scalia's absence. It resulted in a 4-4 tie. And so the Supreme Court opinion itself is just one sentence long. It says the opinion below is affirmed by an equally divided court. So the Supreme Court didn't write anything other than that sentence here. But the implications are huge because of what the lower court, the decision that got affirmed here, said. The story here, just very briefly, about 10 years, maybe a little bit more than that, there was a bipartisan effort to get something through called the DREAM Act. And what it would have been, it never did pass, but what it would have been is it was federal legislation that would have said, if you're here in the country illegally, but you came here as a child, you've been here now for a number of years, you have finished high school or gotten a GED or you've served in the military, you've had a good, clean criminal record, and you're still young, like they argued about what the age limit would be, but you're still young, then we're not going to deport you, okay? Well, that never did get through Congress. And so after many years of trying to get through Congress, the Obama administration ultimately said, well, we'll do this another way. And they adopted a couple of policies saying that as a matter of prosecutorial discretion, which refers to the choices state and federal prosecutors have to make every day, which cases are they going to spend the money on prosecuting, which ones are they going to let go?
And that's significant with 11 or 12 million undocumented workers estimated in the country.
Absolutely. The Obama administration said, using criteria that were very much like what the DREAM Act had proposed initially, if you came here young, good record, finished education or served in the military, then we're going to choose not to prosecute you to get you deported. And then the Obama administration expanded that program to include many parents of those children and others, so that in the end, there were millions of people who were affected and the beneficiaries of these policies from the Obama administration. The lower court has enjoined those. And what that means is they've issued an order saying that those executive policies can't be enforced. There's still going to be a trial on the merits later. It gets technical. I don't think it's worth diving into just where they are in the litigation. But the short story is there's a federal court order now in place issued by a lower court that bars the administration from following this policy nationwide.
Mm-hmm. Going forward, since, as you mentioned, this outcome because of the 4-4 court, will there be any sort of redo possibly in the future when the court has an odd number of justices again?
Yes, that's possible. There will be further legal proceedings in the lower courts here, and it's possible that the loser in those, which will probably be the Obama administration, if it moves along quickly enough to be relevant during his time here, could go back up to the Supreme Court. That's not likely to happen, I would say, within the next year or so because of how long litigation takes to play out. So it could be that in a few years we'll see this case back up in front of the court.
What is your sense of the position this puts DREAMers, undocumented workers who were benefiting from Obama's, I guess, executive move here? Where does that put them? Put them back in limbo with just uncertainty or a possible deportation?
Well, uncertainty about whether they're going to be deported, right? When these before these policies were frozen, you know, when the Obama administration announced them, I think they offered great comfort. You knew that if you fell within those criteria, your local federal prosecutor was not going to try to get you removed from the country. That program is now on hold and possibly gone forever. We'll see. And so I think those who are in the country illegally, even if they meet these criteria, are left to wonder, is my local prosecutor going to come after me, choose to spend their resources getting me out of the country? How long will I evade detection? If I am detected, is anyone going to care? No one can be sure of the answers to those questions. So I think there's a great uncertainty that it introduces.
Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa. I want to turn to Tony Goggin of Drake University's Law School to tell us about another case that examined before the High Court, that examined when a warrant is needed for a breath test versus a blood test. What are the circumstances of this case, Tony?
Yes, Ben. This case is Birchfield v. North Dakota, and in it the Supreme Court held that the Fourth Amendment permits warrantless breath tests incident to arrest for drunk driving, but it does not permit warrantless blood tests. Now, about 12 states make it a crime for a drunk driving suspect to refuse to take a breath alcohol test, and the Supreme Court's ruling in Birchfield upholds those laws. However, the Supreme Court's ruling also strikes down laws in about 12 states that made it a crime for a drunk driver to refuse to take a blood test.
Hmm. So what is the court seeing as a difference between testing your breath and testing your blood?
Ben, the Supreme Court distinguished the two different types of tests on the grounds that although both are searches for the purposes of the Fourth Amendment, the blood test is a far more invasive test, and it results in a blood sample that the police can keep in their files. In contrast, the breath test does not involve a physical intrusion, and it does not produce a sample that is retained in the government's files. And that reasoning attracted 6 of the 8 justices. So this was a fairly large majority in favor of permitting warrantless breath tests. And 7 of the justices voted against permitting warrantless blood tests.
Mm-hmm. Does that change anything for Iowans?
It doesn't for Iowa. Iowa is an implied consent state, as in fact all states are in one way or another, so that if you refuse to submit to a breath test, for example, you can face civil penalties for that. This case was focused on criminal penalties for persons who refuse to take a test.
I guess it could pertain to Iowans traveling outside the state into those 11 states you mentioned.
Yes, absolutely. 2 of them are neighboring states, Minnesota and North Dakota.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting there. Any other words there before we move on to the next case there, Tony?
No, other than Justice Thomas, once again, dissented even from the conservatives. He held that both blood and breath tests should have been permitted.
Mm. Okay. Let's talk, Todd, about a case that's been in the news involving former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell v. United States. Tell us the story behind this one.
Well, former Governor McDonnell undoubtedly is enjoying his Tuesday. He got very good news from the Supreme Court yesterday. By a unanimous vote, the court vacated his convictions. Now, he may be retried, and so the story may yet end unhappily for him. But today, relative to where he was 2 days ago, things have got to be feeling pretty good. Federal bribery law makes it a crime. It's a crime he was convicted of committing. Makes it a crime to perform, quote, an official act in exchange for a gift or money or a loan or something like that. And Governor McDonnell had accepted almost $200,000 worth of gifts, loans, and so forth. He and his wife had the use of a Ferrari for a weekend, the gift of a Rolex that this donor bought to give to the wife, to in turn give it to her husband, loans to help with some ailing rental properties, very sizable wedding gift to the governor's daughter when she got married. And he accepted these things. Now, what did he do in exchange? In exchange, he set up some meetings. He made some introductions. He hosted at least one event, maybe more, at the governor's mansion on behalf of the company that this donor was trying to promote. And the question was, are those official acts? And the court unanimously held that they're not official acts, that setting up a meeting, that's just something that amounts to good government. At least in theory, that's just what politicians do for their constituents. They help facilitate exchanges mm-hmm. of information and so forth. But one of the striking things about that, under federal law today, as the court interpreted the statute, if a governor or any other public official says, you want me to set up a meeting, give me, and then name the price, give me $10,000, give me $100,000, and I'll set up the meeting. I'll make the call, and I'll just make the introduction. That does not violate federal bribery law.
That does not.
It does not violate because all you're doing, the court unanimously said, you're just setting up a meeting. Now, if you exert pressure, if the governor or whoever the public official is gets on the phone and says, I want you to meet with this person. I want you to listen to Hard, and I'd really be pleased if you could see your way clear to, you know, getting a bill introduced or something like that. Then you were starting to test the limits, and we might be violating the federal bribery statute.
I don't know about you. Maybe I don't know about you or any listeners here, but I don't know if I feel great about government where you pay an official to set up a meeting. It seems like getting a gift, but maybe I'm not understanding this.
No, you are understanding. I think you're understanding very well. I think what we find is that the politicians' acts fall into different categories. Some of their acts are praiseworthy. We would all agree that they're praiseworthy. Some of their acts are bad. They're politically objectionable, but they're not violations of federal law.
Okay, there's
and
the
then there are acts that violate federal law, and then state law is layered on top of that. State law could ban these things. And so this case is all about how to read federal legislation as currently drafted. And if Congress wants to toughen up the statute, they certainly can.
Right. And so he can't be prosecuted or he can't be held criminally prosecuted for this, or he can't. But for instance, voters can always say,
sure,
listen, I don't want my public official doing
right. And
that.
Chief Justice Roberts himself, in writing the opinion, said toward the end, this is kind of a tawdry tale, and we're giving our blessing to all of this. But if the issue is, did this violate this federal statute as written? The answer is no.
Okay. Tony, I'd like to have you tell us, we're running out of time. One of the cases that here that we talked about last time has been decided. It's Evanwell v. Abbott, a case in this political season that has to do with voting rights, right?
Yes, that's exactly right, Ben. And this was a unanimous ruling. The Supreme Court held that states may draw legislative district lines, so the state legislative district lines, based on total population rather than on total voting population. Now, the U.S. Constitution, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, requires states to design their legislative districts with equal population, just like their congressional districts. But the question in this case was, does that mean an equal population of voters or an equal population overall in each district? And the plaintiffs in this case sued the Texas governor because the Texas legislative lines had been drawn based on total population. And the plaintiffs claim that their equal protection rights were violated by the state's inclusion of non-voter eligible persons in the calculation of population. And the Supreme Court unanimously rejected the plaintiffs' argument. The Supreme Court noted that since the era of the Founding Fathers, total population was used, not citizen voting population or the vote total population of citizens or voter eligible persons. Now, this case will likely come back up in a different form in that the next question will be, is it permissible to use total voting population instead of total population in a district? And that's something that the court in its ruling carefully avoided reaching. In the background of this is immigration, because the challengers essentially were saying that states with a large percentage of legislative districts with a large percentage of immigrants who were not eligible to vote were receiving a disproportionately large influence in the state legislature. And the Supreme Court in this case has clearly held that that's all right, that this, if the states choose to use total population, it is permissible for them to do so. But this is not the last we've heard of this.
I want to spend the last few minutes talking about some of the things we've been hearing in our news about the Supreme Court. Several months have been going by with a standoff over the filling of the ninth seat left vacant by the death of Antonin Scalia. Just your thoughts on how this has progressed from each of you. I'd like to have those. And when and how this seat is likely to be filled. Todd Pettis.
Well, having gotten this far with refusing to proceed with the nomination of Chief Judge Merrick Garland of the D.C. Circuit, I think it's clear absolutely nothing is happening until the presidential election is over. Once the presidential election happens, the Senate and the rest of us are just nationally citizens are going to take a look at it and say, okay, now what? Because we're going to have a brief period of time, a couple months, where President Obama remains in office. The Garland nomination may remain on the table. And if, for example, Hillary Clinton wins the presidency, there's going to be some intense calculus, I think, happening within the Republican caucus in the Senate trying to decide if Garland is still in front of us, should we go ahead and hurry him through, or would we rather wait and see who Hillary Clinton puts up? And I think their answer to that's going to be pretty clear. Garland is a good judge. He's got strong bipartisan support. He would have been on the Supreme Court in a heartbeat under ordinary circumstances. These just aren't ordinary circumstances.
But it's not inconceivable, or is it possible that Hillary Clinton, should she become president, or that President Obama, should Hillary Clinton win the election, that the Garland nomination be withdrawn so that Hillary Clinton can nominate her own?
That's possible. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's possible.
Tony, weigh in on this. What are your thoughts?
I agree with Todd. That certainly is possible. I would say this is really an unfortunate situation. Clearly, the Senate has an important role to play in advising and consenting on the president's nominees. But I think historians 50 or 100 years from now will look back at this and conclude that the Senate Republicans were playing politics with the Supreme Court. There really is not a compelling, at least in my view, there's not a compelling intellectual defense of what they're doing. And indeed, if we end up not getting a nominee until sometime in 2017, this will likely be the longest vacancy in modern history. The current record, at least over the span of the last 100 years, is 391 days. And that was when Abe Fortas stepped down from the court in 1969, and it took over a year before the next administration was finally able to get Harry Blackmun confirmed. And that's not a record we want to be breaking. We need 9 justices on the Supreme Court, and I think that the Senate Republicans have every right to vote however they want on the president's nominees, but to not even give the president's nominee a hearing and an up or down vote is a departure from certainly modern practice, and it's not a good departure.
Mm-hmm. The Constitution says the Supreme Court justices are nominated by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. Those are the words used in the Constitution. Now, Senator Grassley, head of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, interprets this clause as also including deciding not to advise and consent. So you say 2017, a nominee put forward and hearings and a vote or something like that. Is there any point that the Senate Judiciary Committee has an obligation to hold hearings and take a vote? Or could there be a Democratic president come into the White House, and if the GOP is still in charge of the Senate, could they still say, oh, we're doing our job by not advising and consenting according to it, Tony?
Right. That's the problem, Ben.
Is that a possibility that you could stretch this out even longer than this, the election of the next president?
You know, normally, I would say no, because I would think common sense would prevail. But the last year, both here and abroad, we've seen a lot of examples of political extremism. So at this point, I think anything's on the table. I would note on the hearing issue, it is true that between 1789, when the Constitution was implemented, and 1916, there were never hearings for Supreme Court nominees. There would just be a vote. Louis Brandeis, 100 years ago, was the first Supreme Court nominee to actually get a hearing. But since then, so now 100 years, we've had the practice that the Senate gives the president's nominees a hearing. And I think it would be so disruptive to the institution of the judiciary and, frankly, to the institution of the U.S. Senate itself to allow partisan politics to so undermine the Senate's duty to actually advise and consent on the president's nominees that it's something that I think, regardless of your political background, it's not something to welcome.
Todd Pettis, you share that opinion, Tony's?
Well, I think that, you know, Senator Grassley's position about what the Senate's constitutional obligation is or is not, I think his position is defensible as a legal matter. In fact, I think he's right as a legal matter.
To a point up until the next president is elected.
The Constitution does not clearly require the Senate to hold an obligation to hold a hearing. Now, people read it that way. I'm just giving you my view. I think that it's an intellectually defensible position that the Senate does not have to act. I think the politics of it are something different. I think the desirability of it is something different, like we were talking about with Governor McDonald just a second ago about, you know, just what the law requires and what our political sensibilities tell us are sometimes two different things. And I'm pretty confident that once we get a presidential election, no matter who wins, things are going to move along quickly. I mean, the notion of just holding it off till the next presidential election, that doesn't serve any political party's interests. Unless you're absolutely certain that you're going to control the White House and the Senate for all time forward, you're going to be on the receiving end of some of these practices, and you don't want that. And so you've got to set some precedents so that no matter who's in, who's out, the government can still function. And I think that everyone's going to come to that view in time.
Very quickly in the, I guess, retirement watch segment of our series here, we have really literally a minute here. How many vacancies could there be in the next president's term between 2016 and 2020? Do you have an idea, Todd?
Well, if you're judging by age, we could have quite a few. A number of the justices are older. They tend to be on the conservative side of the spectrum. Justice Ginsburg, the leading notable exception. But we could have a lot of vacancies. But I think that the justices, seeing all this happening with Merrick Garland, I'd be very surprised if anyone this summer kind of leapt into line and said, I'm leading too. So now we've got two contested vacancies.
Tony Goggin, I think I read recently, you could have in a few years a very liberal court, a 7-2 split.
I think that's right, Ben. If you end up with a Democrat winning in November,
exactly.
If you have a Republican winning in November, it's a new ball game because Ginsburg and Breyer, two of the liberal justices, are two of the oldest on the court. So November will be extremely important, the presidential outcome and the Senate outcome, for determining the future of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay. Thank you very much. Tony Goggin, professor of law at Drake University's Law School, joining us in our Des Moines studio. Todd Pettis, the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. What a pleasure to have your expertise and your personalities here to tell us these stories behind these very important cases. Todd and Tony, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth with help from Lauren Knutson. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Of course, tomorrow you'll want to tune in. Politics Day, and boy, do we have a lot of politics to talk about. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.